The Big Picture, brought to you by Bible Society Australia, shining the light of God's Word into every corner of your world. And Sydney's Hope 103.2, there's always hope. The Big Picture, a Christian insight on the world of film, television and popular culture, with magazine editor Ben McKechin and scriptwriter Mark Hadley.
Ahoy, hoy, I am Ben McKechin.
And I'm his Padawan learner, Mark Hadley. Welcome to episode 36 of The Big Picture for the week beginning November 2. And coming up on today's show, there's a disturbance in the Force. Ooh. We check out the latest Star Wars cartoon for kids and grown-ups who love lightsabers.
Mark dares to interview the man behind Only the Dead, one of the hardest-hitting documentaries in living memory.
And top five giant kid things from movie history, Mistress America, and fake preachers at cinemas. There's heaps. But before we get into all of that, hey, how about we find out what's happening this week? Ben, what's happening in the cinemas?
Why don't we do that, Mark? Happening at cinemas this week, we're going to talk about some other new releases later in the show, but one of the films launching around the country this week is No Escape. It's taken a while to get here, this movie. It stars Owen Wilson and the former James Bond, Pierce Brosnan, and they're a bunch of Westerners who are trying to escape a coup that's happening in some Southeastern Asian country. I think it's an undisclosed country going on. It seems like a mix of trying to go for action and drama, obviously set around some real life situations that have been going on in that part of the world the last couple of years. It seems, judging by critical reaction around the world, it seems that people's reactions to this are mixed. So the polar opposite seem to be the movie's either offensive and silly, or it's exciting and unexpected. So you be the judge when you go to cinemas.
I suspect it depends on which country you come from.
Yeah, yes.
Okay, Jamie Oliver is back with Jamie's Superfood. Yes, Jamie's got another program.
Of course he does. It's been a week.
It's been a week. But scheduled for 5th November on Channel 10. Throw away those goji berries, though, and bunches of kale, because apparently this program focuses on everyday superfood that just might help you live to 100.
Mark, here's a bit of new release news this week that I think your family's going to enjoy. Adventure Time Seasons 1 to 5 are in a box set available now on DVD and Blu-ray.
I already own them.
Amazing update from me. I've actually never seen this show. I've got a nearly 9-month-old daughter. It seems to me that the time is coming. I'm not sure how soon, Mark, but the time is coming when Adventure Time is going to go off like a rocket in my house.
Oh, 9 months is almost too late, actually. I will start from 3 months. Okay, well, look, the ABC, speaking of going off like a rocket, the ABC brings us Breathless starting this Saturday. It's a story of secrets, lies, and passions set in London in the 1960s, you guessed it, just before the sexual revolution. Ahoy! It focuses on the lives of doctors and nurses. Is this starting to sound a little repetitive? In a London gynecology unit, and deals with their complex personal and professional battles inside and outside the hospital. Look, if you're into hospital dramas, check out the ABC.
Also going off like a rocket in news this week, Mark, is we're going to be on air on Hope 103.2 FM from Sunday, November 8. We're going to be on every week between 8 and 9. So as opposed to just only having us as a podcast, you can also listen to us live on the radio.
Live.
That, we should just put that at the top of this news thing about what's happening this week. Forget everything else we just said. From November 8, Sundays 8 to 9, tune it to Hope 103.2 FM for us.
Unless, of course, you're a Lego fan. What you'll be doing instead is... Now, my boys would love this one, okay? You see, for the 30th anniversary of Ghostbusters last year, Lego came through with one of the coolest new memorabilia items ever, a Lego version, the iconic Ecto-1 vehicle that had the Ghostbusters driving around it. Yeah, it was cool. However, many fans have been hoping to see the Ghostbusters headquarters come out. Well, as it turns out, their wishes may come true, because a Canadian Toys R Us website may just have jumped the gun a little bit, revealing a Ghostbusters Firehouse Lego set, complete with details on all the minifigures and features it will come with. But it's now been pulled down from the website. Someone made a mistake and has just lost their job. Clearly, the Ghostbusters film's coming out a little later in the year, and I feel that we'll probably be seeing a Lego fire station very soon. Big news for the boys at my house. That's
something
all I can say.
Something we can reveal this week that we're definitely not going to retract is what your kids are watching. And what your kids are watching is Star Wars Rebels. Because it seems that the good people at Disney cannot let a week go by, Mark, without announcing something new Star Wars. The Star Wars Force Awakens trailers recently come out. There's posters, signed commemorative blaster collections, etc., etc. So we thought, of course, it's a perfect time to join in the fun and devote this week's What Your Kids Are Watching segment to, as I said, Star Wars Rebels. It's a swashbuckling sci-fi cartoon devoted to the power of redemption.
This is Master Obi-Wan Kenobi. I regret to report that both our Jedi Order and the Republic have fallen.
In a time of darkness, when fear ruled the galaxy,
move along. This is a restricted area.
Heroes will rise.
Entering hyperspace.
Destinies will collide.
Who is that kid?
And a rebellion will ignite.
I'm going to snuff out this spark before it catches fire.
So, Ben, did you actually ever see The Clone Wars? As in Star Wars,
I,
The Clone
I did.
Wars,
I think I saw series? The movie and I saw some episodes of the show.
No. Sorry. I didn't mean to point out your ignorance there. Star Wars The Clone Wars, yes, but I'm saying the cartoon series.
That that's out. What I'm talking about, Mark. I'm with you on this journey. Okay. When I worked at Empire full-time as a film reviewer, that's one of the many things I had to take in. I didn't really get it. This is where I out myself on this program and say I'm not a huge Star Wars fan, which basically means I'm not hardcore, which really makes me sound like a hater. I understand that. I like Star Wars. I appreciate its space, its cinema history, et cetera, but I'm not that immersed in the universe on a daily lightsaber basis.
That's right, fans. Ben is a hater.
If you took anything from what I just said, that's definitely what it was.
Okay. Well, look, we're actually looking at the next sort of iteration of the Clone Wars cartoons. Star Wars Rebels is a CGI cartoon in the same vein. This one, though, is set 14 years after The Revenge of the Sith and 5 years before the original Star Wars film, A New Hope. So it's in that gap where in which, if you like, the Sith reigns supreme, ruling the Empire.
And we've all got questions about that, let's be honest.
Well, we do at our household, hater. And so, the Rebel Alliance that Princess Leia eventually helps in the original Star Wars, you know, is yet to be formed. There are plenty of people bucking Emperor Palpatine's system, you know, sitting on those park benches when they shouldn't and stuff like that. The key character in this one is a young Force-sensitive boy called Ezra.
Force-sensitive?
Listen, this is why you're going to get hate mail. Now, if you're going to keep doing that. Okay, anyway. He's a Force-sensitive, that's a real thing, boy called Ezra. And he's something of a street urchin on a planet called Lothal. Incidentally, Ezra is the biblical figure who God chose to rebuild the temple. And you see, the Jedi temple has been destroyed. Is this a coincidence? I think not, but there'll be some discussion on some forum somewhere going on. Well, look, the whole sort of force thing is back, that quasi-Hindu nature of this underlying thing connecting all of us, the quintessential life force of the universe. And if we can get in touch with it, still, we're going to achieve amazing things, which, strangely, is what Ezra does. Our street urchin spends the first series pretty much connecting with a surviving Jedi Knight called Kanan. I'm telling you, this
wow.
is rich.
A lot of
rich
biblical material. References.
I know, I know.
I'm already struggling to keep up. Sounds like I need a flowchart to
you
watch
do.
This show.
And this is the interesting. Darth Vader's back. And of course, Ahsoka Tano.
What now?
Yeah, there you go.
From the Clone Wars?
Okay, from the end of the Clone Wars, how she left the Jedi Order. Why do you not know this?
I need a whiteboard. And we're just like, this sounds like, you find the boys at your house keep up with all this? Everyone, if you're not a hater like myself, will you just easily keep up with what's going on?
I think most parents would need a flowchart with this. I mean, let's be honest. I'll drop the laughter for a second to say that if you are a parent and you're watching your kids getting into the Star Wars thing.
And kids are. It's amazing how enduring Star Wars have been since 1977, since the first one's come out, and the various iterations of this. It is incredible how many kids, teens devote themselves, let alone adults, but like kids, how kids latch onto this.
It's moved from just being a film to being a cultural phenomena. I mean, and the fact that it's powered by toys and everything like that keeps it alive in the younger generation that moves up, and then people like to think about it almost philosophically. I mean, I know that some people think the Jedi religion, trying to get that onto the census, you know, is a joke, and yet at the same time, some people kind of take that view of the world seriously.
So what do you think a parent should think if their kids are starting to dive into Star Wars Rebels?
Well, look, there's two things. Firstly, you know, should you be worried? Yes, because the whole Star Wars thing is backed by a huge marketing endeavor. I mean, this is the major thing I think parents should be aware of, that it sucks kids into a whole toy range, to a whole Happy Meal range, to a whole sort of coloring in book range.
You know, I know, you look Ewoks, they're so cute.
But you look at educational institutions that are supposed to be sending books to our children at school, and you'll see them flooded with quasi-educational books that are all Star Wars themed. So in essence, I think parents have got to be aware, just because it happens to be such a large phenomena and it can suck kids away from maybe real reading.
A massive merchandise machine.
Yeah, into this machine, into buying and all that sort of stuff. Do they have to worry about the Force? That's something that people ask a lot. Look, there is a whole lot of Hindu sort of influence on the Force, okay? So in the same way that the Hindu religion, and look, I'm aware for people who are Hindus who might be listening, that when I say Hindu religion, I really am making a broad brushstroke, because Hinduism itself is made up of many, many, many subsets of faith. But this idea of the Force linking everything is really in Star Wars not used as a religious item. It's more like potential. You know, you've got the way it's presented in television series and films, you've got the potential, you know, for the Force. If you concentrate and you draw down on this power, which ultimately resides inside of you, you can be great. Mm. Everyone can somehow
be Jedi-like. To wrap up on Star Wars Rebels, I've got two questions for you. What's the key theme of the show? Is it this, the Force, the potential, try to tap into that in yourself? And do you like the show?
Look, I think firstly, I like the show. I think that's fun. And I think it's actually one of those things which I can say to my boys, if you've got young boys in your house, do you want to watch something together? They are in for it. Okay, so that's
They form a rebel alliance in your lounge
room.
They
form an alliance. They arm themselves with the many plastic lightsabers over our house. We all sit down together. Yes, I do have my own one. Mine's red. I'm a Sith. Anyway, so someone has to be in the household. And if you get people up at 6 a.m. in the morning, you obviously are Sith. You know, so sitting down is a kid thing, you know, it's great to do. That's good. I think that the thing that I want to actually show my kids through the series, though, particularly, you know, Star Wars Rebels, is just this whole concept of redemption. All of the key characters come from broken and lost backgrounds. Now, Ezra is your kind of street urchin straight out of Oliver Twist. You know, he's basically been stealing his whole life. He has no real moral ground. And yet when he meets people who have a cause to live for, he realizes he can be different. He can change. You know, that life can quickly turn around. And from a Christian perspective, I want my boys to see that we are never so lost that we can't be redeemed. You can stop and turn, and the moment you turn towards God, you find him calling you and drawing you the whole way. And so that's throughout the series. There are heaps of people ready to repent, and they've got a really good definition of repentance inside of Star Wars Rebels. It means to stop, to turn around, and to go the other way. Start doing the opposite of what you used to be doing. And if my kids pick up that much, that's well worth watching.
Bravo. And even from a hater, I can tell you that Star Wars Rebels is in high rotation on Foxtel's DXD channel. It's rated PG for parents needing guidance if they're going to be able to separate all these characters. I see what you did there. Mark, what's coming up on the rest of the show?
Well, coming up on the show, we've got some brilliant stuff to have a look at. Mistress America is a sort of quasi-new American comedy coming out, and I want you to hang around for Believe Me. Believe Me is a Christian film that I would go as far as to say is the best Christian film I have ever seen.
Dang!
It's Mark and Ben with The Big Picture, a Christian look at popular culture, and we've come up to Soundtrack, a segment of our week where we look at basically where music and film intersect. Ben, what are you doing?
Yeah, before we get on to our first now showing review of this edition, Mistress America, I'm going to play to you something that turns up in Mistress America.
Yeah.
Mark, that's the groovy-licious 80s sounds of the band Toto performing Rosanna. Man, my family, we used to flog one of Toto's albums when I was younger. Like, my parents loved the sounds of Toto. We loved the sounds of
that
Toto.
That and Africa, seriously.
And Africa got a punishing in our house. That song, Africa, not the continent.
We,
Africa.
Of course, are in support of Africa.
Yes, we are. Also in support of Rosanna's Toto showing up in Mistress America, this new film on its cinemas at the moment. I don't know if you know this, Mark, but the song Rosanna was actually a tribute to the actress Rosanna Arquette. Rosanna Arquette is still on our screens these days, but it was a particular tribute for a role that she played in a film called After Hours, this 80s screwball little-known film from Martin Scorsese that he made. And so the band members of Rosanna thought, Toto thought we should write a song about her. Also inspiring, Rosanna Arquette, at least her character in After Hours, also that character inspired the makers of Mistress America, and I'll go on to talk about this in a few minutes' time. But the lead character in Mistress America is heavily based on Rosanna Arquette's character in After Hours, hence why the song Rosanna is used in Mistress America. Man, I'm all over the shop with these names. Let's just play more of the song.
I just don't want to finish it. That's cool. Can't we play more? Oh, Ben, you're a hater of a lot of things in this show.
Mate, I just enthuse about the sounds of Rosanna and Toto?
You're right.
I also am heart ached by lacking in so much Rosanna, but we should move on to Mistress America.
We should move on to Mistress America because we're not talking about Star Wars anymore at the moment on account of the fact
hater.
That Ben hates it. Yes. Noah Baumbach's name is almost as tough to say as the Visits director M. Night Shyamalan.
You struggle with that guy's name.
I do. But we've been saying Noah Baumbach a fair bit this year. Ben and I love Baumbach's While We Were Young, the midlife hipster's delight that starred Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts. Check out the review at thebigpicturewebsite.com.
Well worth it.
Yeah, While We Were Young came out about 6 months ago, but Baumbach is back with another loving and biting observation of generation divides. Mistress America centers on a 30s woman in New York City dealing with, like, life, basically.
You know. She's just dealing, man.
Like life, yeah. And laughs and delusion happen along with considerable comment about how we talk about the flaws of our friends.
I was sleeping. Turn that off.
Sorry. I'm your roommate. You know the feeling of being at a party where you don't know anybody? College is like that the whole time.
You should call Brooke.
I hear she's fun.
Hey, baby Tracy.
Being around Brooke made you want to find life. Not hide from it.
I'm gonna shorten that, punch it up, and turn it into a tweet.
She sang with the band and knew everyone and didn't owe anyone anything and couldn't pay up even if she did.
High five, sister. That was an amazing night.
Best of my life.
You got a honey?
No. There's just one guy.
Hey.
Hey.
But he's got a girlfriend.
There's no cheating when you're 18. You should all be touching each other all the time.
That's just some of the life advice, Mark, that's offered by Mistress America, who's this character, Brooke, played by Greta Gerwig, a really funny, great actress. She's been in a few Noah Baumbach films, including Frances Ha and Greenberg a number of years ago with Ben Stiller as well. So Brooke is this New York 30-something who seems to be something of an encapsulation of a woman around that age, and men as well, and that that clip I think successfully demonstrates a lot of what happens in Mistress America, which is just basically this like this long string of amazing insights and observations about her world and existence as served up by Brooke. And the reason we're getting all of that is because a young lady called Tracy, played by a really cool actress called Lola Kirk. I've never seen her before, but both she and Greta Gerwig, great comic timing, really good dramatic ability, they're fantastic on screen. So this younger character, Tracy, is off to college and she hooks up with Brooke, who is the daughter of, so her mum is marrying a bloke and the bloke's daughter is Brooke. And so these two almost sisters start hitting the town, and Tracy really looks up to Brooke, but as the movie goes along, she learns more about where Brooke actually is at and what she's about. And, well, you know, issues ensue.
I know. I get the feeling that, like, we're doing more of that while you're young sort of while we're young storyline. Like, yeah, this whole sort of hipster lifestyle and the dark side of it. Is this where Bormack's
going? Yeah, sort of poking fun at it as well as celebrating at the same time. There's a bit of that here, but it doesn't feel like a remake of While We're Young. And given that film was only out 6 months ago, that's a really good thing. This focuses on someone slightly younger than the characters in While We're Young. And the purpose seems to be more about presenting a woman, but again, I think she stands in for blokes as well. Women at a time in their life, particularly in the West, where you seem to have everything at your feet and yet you can't grab hold of anything at the same time. There's all these really interesting contrasts and contradictions going on in this character of Brooke up on screen. She's a fascinating, frustrating character. So you get everything from she's a young woman who seems to have done everything and can do anything, but yet is desperate to find something that lasts and something that's actually substantial as well. And she flies all over the place trying to do this, that, and the other, but never really does anything. And when she's challenged on her views and her thoughts on stuff, she gets super defensive and really quite aggressive when you even just try to critique an idea that she puts forward. And I don't think the film's necessarily trying to say this is how all 30-somethings are, but I think there are definitely a lot of people around that are in this sort of weird child-adult limbo land that Brooke encapsulates and Tracy is effectively viewing, and she's heading towards this as well. Mm. And Tracy's a wannabe writer. She's an aspiring author, and she starts writing short stories about what she sees in Brooke, and she also does a lot of she does some critiquing of just Brooke's philosophies on life.
Yeah, look, I know that earlier in the show we established beyond all doubt that you are a hater of Star Wars, but I'm going to start sounding like an old man, okay, because I actually wonder if she is a spokesperson for her generation. Brooke does sound very much like that sort of person who really what really frustrates me the most about well, honestly, Gen Y. You know, lots of potential, but lots of, I don't know.
Yeah, and you do get a lot of that in Mistress America, which is very funny, I should say. It's like While We're Young, some of the ways that this celebrates and skewers at the same time. I think Noah Baumbach, and he co-wrote this with Greta Gerwig, this lead actress. They do a very good job of that, of putting that up on screen. I think you're right to some degree, and maybe I should have more strongly said, I think she definitely presents loads of things about this particular age group. To say she's a spokeswoman, I just think might be going too far. It seems too absolute. Like, not everybody is like this, but it does encapsulate a lot of the times. It definitely does do that in this incredible character of Brooke. Doesn't necessarily sustain the whole film, though. A criticism I've got of Mistress America is it sort of wears out its welcome a bit. It's a movie that rambles through various great, like, situations of just characters interacting and you're getting these snapshots of life, and it's all very funny and hip and cool. But the longer it tries to go along as a story, when it gets to this point of Brooke confronting a woman that she blames for stealing her fiance and ruining her life, when you get to that, you get some really great dramatic scenes, but it feels like you've just chucked this stuff in this movie to propel it along and to try to bring it to some sort of conclusion, when the movie really feels like you're basically just trying to reflect on the times, not necessarily tell us what to think about the times.
Okay, so it's got a bit of a meandering end, but look, yeah, you're talking about this relationship predominantly between Tracy and Brooke.
Yeah, that really drives the film.
So Tracy sees the criticisms she has for Brooke. She writes some stories about it. Is that how you deal with your problems? Oh, my friend has issues. I think I'll write a story about that. Does she do anything more active than that?
as you watch Mistress America, what you can be struck by is Brooke particularly, and just, yeah, and you would be thinking as you're watching that film how you would deal with something. I mean, you might be a person like that, and maybe you might want to think about how you reflect on life and where you find meaning and purpose and what you invest in. But watching how Tracy handles it, no, I don't think she demonstrates a good approach for it, because what she actually says is true.
Does she give her the short stories? This is about you. Read this.
Brooke comes to see some of it, and while what Tracy's saying isn't untrue, it's actually a bit too harsh, possibly. It's very frank, very blunt. And Brooke is a person that doesn't respond well to that. So as an approach, if you are thinking through how you're going to approach telling someone about how they are and telling them like it is, I don't know if writing short stories, thinly veiled short stories about other characters that are critiquing someone's character is necessarily the way to go.
Possibly just talking to them about it.
Yeah, I would say so, which is very difficult for us to do, right? When you watch movie characters on screen, you think, oh, well, you know, you should have done this or you should have done that. Mistress America, as much as I didn't find all the conclusions satisfying and as funny and as dramatic as the build-up, what you can take away from it is maybe talk to your friends if you have issues with how they're going.
But let me just
talk to them.
Let me just pursue this for a second. Do you think we actually live in a non-confrontational culture?
Yes.
Like in a sense, because it's enough for us to say, hey, you know, it would have been really good if she actually sat down and talked to her friends. As a Christian, you know, when Jesus says, if you've got a problem with your brother, you're basically supposed to go and try and talk to your brother about it. But we don't live in that age, do we?
No. Well, yes and no. I said yes before emphatically, but there's also the no. So the yes is we like to avoid conflict, particularly the face-to-face contact. We still find that very difficult, myself included. No, just go online and see all the vitriol that people like flare up on with social media particularly.
Yeah, but that's at a distance.
And there's an undercurrent of that going on in Mistress America. So again, as a portrait of the times and the ways that we approach things, you're right, you've kind of hit the nail on the head. We live in a conflict-averse time, which is still, though, dripping with conflict. And so Mistress America, I don't think is a helpful portrait necessarily of how you go about dealing with that, but it might spark you to think about how you would better go about it.
Yeah, I think we all need an approach on how we're actually going to deal with our friends' problems, not the least of which our own. Okay, well, Mistress America stars Greta Gerwig and Lola Kirk. It's now showing at cinemas and is rated MA-15+ for strong, coarse language. While there is a lot of swearing in the film, it's a surprise that it received such a high rating.
I was surprised. Yeah, I'm not trying to dampen down the effects of swearing, but I was really surprised it copped an MA-15+. We just mentioned social media. We're all over social media, or at least we're on it. Check us out on Facebook and Twitter. We're one of those people in the vast ocean of stuff that are doing things on social media. And what we should really be broadcasting across there this week, Mark, is definitely that, as we said at the top of the show, we're going to be on air from November 8th.
November 8th is a big day for us.
I think the internet is going to stop this week as we just pollute it with noise about how we're going to be on air, Hope 103.2, from November 8th, Sundays from 8 till 9.
Tune in. It'll be fresh. Much fresher when it comes straight off the radio to you. Coming up in the show, we actually have a great review of a Christian film coming up. I call it a great review, actually, because it's mine. Believe me, if I were you, I would check this film out, but hang around to hear what I have to say about it. Also, Adrian Drayton is back with our segment, The Vault. Now, I really want to encourage you to hang around for that because it plays out for our top five this week, our top five giant kid things. Okay, so look forward to that too, coming up in the show.
The Big Picture, Christian Insight to Pop Culture with Ben and Mark. Our second now showing choice for this week is Believe Me. Now, I think we need to face this, Mark. Christians have a troubled history when it comes to films. I believe that is true. If the key characters are created by people who don't believe in Jesus, then they tend to be stereotypical flakes, wimps, or even deviants. But Christian producers haven't had much more joy. They've often produced heroes who only make sense in the Southern American Bible Belt. Yeah, I think that's a fair comment. But it's a new heritage film release called Believe Me, and it's a welcome exception. It neatly treads between the two extremes to produce a story that's entertaining to those who don't believe in Jesus, but still is faithful to what believers are all about.
We have decided to give tonight's offering towards our missionaries and their efforts.
Why do people go to charity events?
Because they want to help people.
Wrong.
Because they want to feel like they're helping people.
Excuse me, could you just tell me who's running this event?
Praise God. Thank you all so much for coming out.
Ken Huffman, Executive Director, Cross Country. I have every intention of putting you on the national stage.
I'm curious. We would love to hear more about your work in Lesotho.
Yeah, this is really the Lord's work, wouldn't you say?
Amen. Amen.
Believe Me is about a group of college graduates struggling under mountains of debt. The key character is Sam Russell. You might actually remember him from... Sorry, Sam. The key character is Sam, played by Alex Russell, and you might remember him from Chronicle, which is a brilliant sort of insight into Gen Y and what might happen if they actually did get superpowers. Well, this is not in that context. Sam is confronted with unexpected tuition bills that no superpowers are going to take away, and he convinces his friends that their salvation lies in fleecing the faithful. Basically, take on a fake Christian charity, digging wells in Africa, and ask gullible church dudes to give you the money. Well, the scam hooks them line and sinker, and Sam's God Squad takes off on an almost national tour across America, and behind the curtain of all this sort of great glitz and glamour in the Christian community, Sam discovers that the world of Christian celebrity is really full of fake enthusiasts and half-baked stars swimming in a sea of gullibility. This becomes a justification then for Sam and his friends to keep rorting the system. Why not? Because if they're convincing people of stuff that they'll believe anyway, well, why not earn a little bit of money along the way? And if they're doing something wrong, well, in the end, at least they're fanning people's hope in whatever they hope in. Okay, so what the hell can go wrong is a sign that, you know, is one of the things that the character says. And I love the response where his mate says, hell is what could go wrong. Okay? Sam discovers his conscience as he grows closer to the Christians who actually come to believe in what he's peddling, not because they're stupid, but because they actually want to serve God. And he's struck by this in the end. And Riot Studios is behind this. I've just got to say, Riot Studios is a very clever production company for documentaries. They did One Nation Under God, you might have seen that, or Beware of Christians. Two pretty cool documentaries worth looking up. This is a team of Christians who are well aware of the problems in the Christian community and the sort of things that hang around what should actually be a pure message of the gospel. And so I can't say enough to say that Believe Me is really what we should be watching when we say, hey, let's look at a Christian film.
But I know you're not a massive fan of Christian movies. I think that's a fair comment to make.
That's right. I am a hater.
As a rule, you are a hater of Christian production. How come?
Look, I now see that the shoe is on the other foot, or the lightsaber is on the other side of the belt. How this term hater can actually hang around your neck. I know what you mean, though. When it comes to looking at Christian film, I have a real problem, and that's basically because there's a presumption in the Christian community that because we are talking about something that is infinitely valuable, that people should listen. Okay, now think about that for a moment, because it colors Christian books. It is so important what I'm writing about that I can make this Christian book so boring, and yet you still have to feel guilty by wading through the turgid prose that somebody might actually have written. I mean, it's just the way it goes. And Christian films
suffer. That can be true of Christian books, yeah. Yes.
And some Christian films suffer from the same sort of thing. This is a story about Christians who believe, and so it's sometimes poorly written, it's poorly acted, the concepts are so weak, you don't understand why people do what they do in the end, and yet non-Christians should be amazed by this story. We should take our non-Christian friends along. Are you kidding me? Half the time I wouldn't, because I'd rather give them a clear view of what Christianity is by taking them to church instead and letting them meet real Christians.
And so it sounds like you're saying, though, Believe Me, which is about people not giving a clear view of Christianity, at least not being honest about their faith and their convictions, and being fake televangelists, guys mounting Christian campaigns, but you're saying Believe Me is almost an antidote to those Christian movies that you're
Absolutely.
Describing. And you can take Christians and people who aren't Christian along.
Absolutely. Thank you, Heritage Film, for basically getting this into Australia. Believe Me is basically believable. Okay, the first thing is, from a non-Christian perspective, we don't play any loose and fast games and having these sort of like super righteous, super copable Christians, you know, who can handle almost anything. Believe Me starts off by admitting a lot. Okay, that there is a lot of frippery and marketing and stuff that hangs around Christianity that really isn't Christianity. There's a lot of Pharisaism, standing up and praying on the street corner, so to speak, although these days it requires standing on a stage with a huge stack of speakers behind you, a light show and a microphone. It's the same sort of stuff that Jesus would never have approved. And so non-Christians get to see that and go, see, I told you so. And Christians have to swallow that and admit it. And they do in the film.
So what will they take away? What will people people take away? So if you are a follower of Jesus, what are you going to take? And then someone who isn't, like, is the message of Jesus actually proclaimed in Believe Me?
Yes, that's the beautiful thing about it, because Christians actually hear exactly what they really would say in those circumstances. A non-Christian says, what about all this hypocrisy? And they say, look, that's not what Jesus is about. And that's the best possible example and answer that I could say. And again, well, the non-Christian says in this, Sam says, look, in the end, it's all about hope, isn't it? And the Christian says, a very reasonable hope in what? I can't help but feel that, you know, hope without Jesus is no hope at all. You know, so I think the Christians are believable. I think the challenges for the Christian faith are believable. And I think overall, non-Christians will look at this film and go, hey, you know, I'm actually kind of entertained by this and at the same time made to think what is I do believe in. And Christians aren't going to be squishing in their chairs going, oh gosh, another syrupy, sappy number.
Wow, from a Christian movie, from a Christian guy who's a Christian movie hater, he's really recommending a Christian movie. Believe Me, it stars Alex Russell. He's an Australian, I think, Alex Russell.
Yeah, he is.
Zachary Knighton and Parks and Recreation's Nick Offerman. Nice one. And it's rated M for mature themes. So it's available for cinema screenings around the country through fanforce.com. If you want to put this on in your local cinema somewhere, go to fanforce.com and it'll give you all the details of how you can do that.
No so, shame. Honestly, this will be a no shame presentation.
You and it's really also going to be available on DVD and video on demand. Big change of pace now, Mark, with the big picture for this week. We're at our press record segment. And, well, it, like, just trying to prepare people. I'm dropping the voice. I'm trying to get serious because this is super serious. There's an Australian journalist called Michael Ware who's seen more than his fair share of the darker side of humanity. He's a guy who was stationed in Baghdad for over 7 years by Time magazine and CNN to cover first the Gulf War, then the insurgency, and finally the Al-Qaeda atrocities that followed. Now, during that time, he carried around a personal video camera with him and he made notes of the things that he was reporting on. And this footage has now been released in a new documentary, Only the Dead, that's as riveting as it is revolting. Michael Ware not only captures the dark heart of the Middle East, he chronicles his discovery of the same darkness in his own heart. Mark caught up with him in his Queensland home this week for our press record segment to talk about this disturbing journey of self-discovery.
Michael, thanks very much for being part of The Big Picture and also allowing us to talk to you about your new documentary, Only the Dead. Look, I've got to say, your documentary is unrelenting. I mean, its exposure of the atrocities wrapped up in the current Middle East conflicts. But that's not really the purpose of it, is it? I got a sense as we were watching it that it wasn't just about these are all the things that are going wrong, but more a personal angle?
Well, yes, you're right. In one sense, this story does, in fact, take place in the prehistory of what we now call the Islamic State. And the focus of the narrative is my dealings with the man who created the Islamic State and what my pursuit of him through the most hellish parts of the war not only revealed about the war itself, but also revealed about me. So in some ways, it is a personal story because you'll see that I find a hidden darkness lurking in my soul that I never knew I had. And that's what we hope is the broader conversation that comes out of this film, is that this is a film that, yes, takes place in a war that happens to be in Iraq, but really this was an opportunity to look at all of us, to look at the human condition, to look at that light and that dark that lives or dwells inside each and every one of us.
You talk a lot about this dark place within the human heart, you know, as the documentary goes through, and I think it's wonderful in a sense because it makes us all to some degree responsible for what goes on. It's not to say that these people aren't any more responsible for their actions, but rather it's an issue that seems to be pertinent for all of us. Can I ask you, when did you first become aware of its presence during your work? What did you see around it that started to change your perspective, to start to make you aware of that?
Well, obviously it's very trite to say that war changes you. And I was in Iraq for over 7 years, so there was change obviously happening within me each and every day. And it there were certain moments or certain events during those years that held the mirror up for me to reflect on that as it was happening. But, you know, by and large, it was that desensitization. It's extraordinary what one can become accustomed to. War became my normal. You change in the face of constant human suffering and in the face of our own unending, unrelenting inhumanity.
There's a philosophical perspective you're wrestling with throughout the documentary, which I think is really interesting, because there is one view of the world that would say that at the core, we're basically good people and given the chance, we'll do everything good. You sort of suggest maybe something else, that at the core, we've got a fundamental problem, that there is something in our hearts that we keep going back to. I guess that's what you're trying to get at with the title, Only the Dead Are Going to Really Be Free of War.
Well, that's right. I mean, the title of the film comes from that well-known expression, only the dead have seen the end of war. Now, if that's true, and I believe it is, because look at history, we've not been free of war, and in our present situation, we're not even free of it now. So if that is in fact true, that only the dead have seen the end of war, then war is as much a part of the human condition as is a mother's love for her child. You know, it's often been said that, you know, we have both the light and the dark inside us. You know, and what Joseph Conrad wrote about in The Heart of Darkness in the 1890s, and Francis Ford Coppola turned into the brilliant film in 1979, Apocalypse Now, it turns out I accidentally and inadvertently filmed in Iraq. So the footage that I eventually came home with lent itself to that very story and to that very issue. And at the end of the day, though, I'd like to think that we need to acknowledge this darkness within the human soul, because only by really acknowledging it and only by really coming to some understanding of it can we ever truly hope to fully embrace the light.
Well, at the risk of steering the conversation like almost into one particular focus, what's your opinion of militant Islam? It's almost impossible to look at your documentary without seeing it, I guess, in its best, but possibly in its worst lights too. You seem to make friends with some in some camps and none in others. How did you react to that entire sort of, approach to life over there?
Well, it was a thing, obviously, of fascination to me, to be able to reach out and touch this virulent, militant kind of Islam, because not only was it right there in front of me, and not only was I on a path that led me into its deepest recesses, but, you know, I could also see from what was going on around me that this kind of militant Islam was going to keep impacting upon us, not just in that region, but around the world for generations to come. So it was like being able to see our future beginning to unfold right then and right there. And the lessons that I learned over those years still hold me in good stead now when it comes to trying to contemplate the nature of the Islamic State and what... when it comes to trying to fathom solutions and answers.
Mate, what do you think is the best case scenario for you, for people coming away from Only the Dead?
I would like to think that Only the Dead poses a whole host of questions for every audience. And we don't answer those questions because it's up to you, each and every individual member of the audience, to find those answers for yourself.
Mate, thank you very much for your time on the show today.
Mate, it's my great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I've got to say that I was really impressed with meeting Michael Ware, mainly because
he has come to the conclusion that many, you know, Christians already know, you know, the answers in the back of the book. We have a problem in humanity. He doesn't particularly claim a personal faith himself, but he is aware of the problem. And that's a long way along the track to finding out the solution. Look, I just encourage you to actually have a go at looking at Only the Dead. It is disturbing footage. I just want to emphasize that again. It is difficult watching.
It's rated R, isn't it?
It's rated R in Australia.
And we don't normally talk about R-rated films on this show.
I would not recommend, generally speaking, a rated R film, but rated R documentary lets you, at least you know what you're looking at.
So approach with caution, but the subject matter is
real,
riveting.
And that's why it's rated R. Okay, well, by the way, if you're thinking to yourself that you actually could do with a bit more information about this, the next edition of Eternity, I write quite a lengthy review of Only the Dead, basically focusing on how it brings out the dark place inside every human being, including the director, Michael Ware. And he talks about his journey more in that particular interview, which I use of the article, and the darkest heart of the Middle East, and also his personal discovery of the darkness in his own soul. So well worth a read for Eternity this coming Sunday.
Coming up on the show, something completely different. There's going to be giants. We're going to have a giant family favourite from the vault before Mark unveils the top five giant kid friendly things. Stick around.
Now, regular listeners to the show will know that a few weeks ago, we kicked off our newest segment, The Vault. Because movie history is so enormously massive.
Massive!
The intrepid reviewers at Insights Magazine websites have teamed up with us to search it out for you. Some top old school choices.
We're just trying to be of help. Us and Insights are just trying to help you out.
How could you possibly know what you need to know without this sort of
help? We are so amazingly helpful, Mark.
We're just nice. Anyway, this week, Insights editor Adrian Drayton has something special to share that he reckons just might be one of the greatest family films you have ever seen.
Adrian, once again, you've come back up out of the massive archive of the vault. You're scraping off the cobwebs and the dust and all that kind of thing. And you've returned with...
Well, I've returned with a film from 1999, a little-known animated film, maybe to people who listen to The Big Picture, or maybe it isn't a little-known one, but it's The Iron Giant.
Oh, The Iron Giant.
Which was released in 1999.
Yeah. Now before you get to the nitty-gritties of why you went through the vast archives of the vault and returned with The Iron Giant, why don't you just tell us what it's about first?
It's set in small town Maine in 1957, and it's about a boy called Hogarth who befriends a mysterious 50-foot robot that has crash-landed.
It's every boy's story, Adrian.
It is every boy's story. Crash-landed near their town from outer space. And Hogarth, who was raised on a bit of a steady diet of alien invasion B-movies, kind of is a bit excited at first, but then he has to try his best to hide the presence of his large metallic friends from his family and those around him. He also has to keep it secret from a snooping government agent, but ends up sharing this secret with Dean, a jazz-loving beatnik sculptor. I love that. Who runs a local scrapyard.
Why, of all the movies you could recommend to us, did you pick this 999 animated film?
Well, I think because it predates a lot of CGI films.
So it's still more the hand-drawn style of animation.
It is. It's a hand-drawn style of animation.
This must have been just before Toy Story.
It's just after Toy Story, because if you remember, Toy Story is 1995, but it's actually one of the few last hand-drawn animated films, really, to come out before the 2000s. I mean, there's a few Chinese and Japanese films that have come out. They still use traditional hand-drawn animation, but this is probably one of the last few American films that use that technique. And the really interesting thing for me about the film is that it doesn't actually have a villain, but violence and paranoia are the villains, really. And Brad Bird, who's the director, drew his inspirations from a number of unlikely sources. One of them was those cliched educational films about the Cold War, you know, the old duck and cover films.
Oh, yeah, from like the 50s, 60s.
Yeah, from the 50s and 60s. And so the whole film has a kind of that feel to it, sort of a B-movie type feel.
And does it still endure, Adrian? Can you still watch it again now?
It does still endure because of what it says about things like the fact that we should lay down our arms and sort of use our hearts and minds to solve problems. Given the political landscape now, it seems like it's a bit of a prophetic film in some ways. I think the film is also really entertaining because it's about a central relationship which drives the film, and it deals with real issues like death and bigotry, which are pretty hot topics for a children's animated film, but in an honest and really heartfelt way. And I think it also reminds us that heroism, it comes in lots of different forms. But my primary thing is it's a really great film for kids who are kind of being, to some degree, brought up on this sort of dystopian idea about guns and violence and things like that. It's a really anti-violent, anti-gun film. It's a film that all families can watch.
And so in short, Adrian, to wrap up The Vault, it sounds like you are suggesting an all-ages animated film from 1999, The Iron Giant, that you think largely ticks all the boxes.
Absolutely.
You heard it, friends. Ticks all the boxes, The Iron Giant. It was directed by Brad Bird, and he also directed, as Adrian was just discussing in that clip, Tomorrowland, which is available on DVD at the moment. Now, you can go to Insight's website, which is Insight's... Adrian is the editor, the guy who looks after all stuff at Insight's on the webs and the magazines. You can go to insights.uca.org.au and you can check out Adrian's really interesting article called Should We Buy Into the Apocalyptic Future? Because he weaves together Tomorrowland and Iron Giant in this really quite great reflection on whether we should buy into several movies that have been going around at the moment, particularly for young adults, particularly about dystopian futures, particularly Hopeless. And he contrasts that with what's going on in Tomorrowland and The Iron Giant. So to hear more of those thoughts where Adrian pushes a very strong argument, I think, for there's a lot of hope being projected in Tomorrowland, go and check out what he's got to say on that at insights.org.uca.au.
Well, this week in our top five...
Beauty of radio, Mark. Beauty of radio.
We are so ready to go live.
Were you saying this week in the top five?
This week in our top five list, we decided we take a lead from Adrian Drayton's vault selection and go hunting for big things. I mean, really big things. Because if there's one thing we've learned about kids, you can get away with a lot in the way of bad scripts and appalling acting and direction, so long as you give them a really, really, really big distraction. So, ladies and gentlemen, I give you the Big Picture's top five list of giant kid things.
Five.
And what better place to start than the BFG?
Yeah, Based on one.
Now, this was actually first made as a film in 1989. The BFG, if you don't know, stands for Big Friendly Giant. It's based on Roald Dahl's novel of a girl named Sophie who encounters the big friendly giant who has become an outcast because he refuses to eat boys and girls. Now, there's actually a remake coming up next year and by director Steven Spielberg. So I'm really kind of excited to see this come out. Steven Spielberg's doing it and it'll be released soon. Honourable mention, though, should also go to another big, less than cuddly thing in Aliens vs. Monsters.
I like that movie.
I know. You see, if you're going to have big, friendly things that don't really mean you any great harm, well, 2009's Alien vs. Monsters also had the Insectosaurus. Less cuddly value, but still at the same time quite big and distracting.
Four.
Speaking of big and distracting things, though,
yes,
Jurassic Park 1993 gave us probably one of the most terrifying distractions for kids, big things that they'll probably remember through most of their nightmares.
Less cuddly, more eat you.
Remember that famous water glass vibration scene? Yes, you guessed it. It's the T-Rex in Jurassic Park. Apparently, before Crichton's novel was published, four studios put in bids for the film rights, and Spielberg acquired it for $1.5 million.
That's all.
Because he was so keen to do this. And what did he do? Well, basically, dinosaurs were created in a groundbreaking way on film and TV.
For kids, or at least for like family audiences largely.
Exactly. And so, you know, kids who've loved dinosaurs for ages finally got to see what it would be like to be near one. Okay, just take that on board. And to showcase the film's sound design, interestingly, Spielberg actually launched an entire company, the creation of DTS. You know, so you talk about surround sound now like it's no big deal. Okay, but surround sound came about because of Jurassic Park. Also, by the way, if we're talking
That just sounds like a big thing to distract adults with.
Another thing to distract you, sort of childish fathers who have, like myself, who have to go and buy a new sound system every time something comes out. Look, another honourable mention for huge, scary things for kids, Smaug. Basically, if they haven't been terrified enough by the T-Rex, just go and show them the desolation of Smaug and tell them that he's coming around to eat them or something. That'll probably help. Let's move on.
Three.
If we've talked about big friendly giants and not so friendly giants, let's talk on to big friendly architecture.
Howl's Moving Castle from 2004, based on the British novel by Diana Wynne Jones, and directed and scripted by Hayao Miyazaki, my personal...
Sensei. You're Mr. Miyagi for your Karate Kid.
I know. This is basically a Ghibli Studios classic. If you haven't got into Japanese comics, it's a fantastic...
What's wrong with you and you should?
It's a fantastic place to start with your kids. Howl's Moving Castle introduces us to this huge floating castle. It's a brilliant building with legs that walks around the countryside, which Howl, you know, the wizard, lives inside of. It's a brilliant sort of funny and imaginative and truly beautiful story about actually being able to put evil aside in your own life and stop embracing that which is ultimately destroying you. But it brings us on to my next big friendly thing. Two. How could I have a list about big things for kids without saying Big Hero 6? Okay, so 2014's my favourite cartoon film for the year, because it introduced me. Yeah, because it introduced me to Baymax.
Oh.
Okay, now Baymax is this brilliant sort of inflatable superhero, a plus size Baymax robot, who basically makes friends with a young boy who lives in the fictional city of San Francisco. Now
I see what they did there.
Yeah, it's nice. I've got to say that you've got a really nice melding for a film in of basically Japanese and American culture. It comes together really well.
Yeah, they do
really
weave
well.
That together nicely. Yes,
it's really
and
nice.
And Baymax is right at the heart.
And Baymax,
the beating, huggable, helium-y, like, yeah, soft, cushiony heart.
He's something like he's a very touching character, or touchable, I guess, as you say. He's got this strength of character of the true hero, but the bodily consistency of a marshmallow. Which basically brings us to my top big thing worth looking out for kids.
One.
Remember that little old film Ghostbusters in 1984? Director Ivan Reitman introduced us to Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, and Sigourney Weaver as people who are basically spending too much time with the supernatural. Well, one of the climactic moments in Ghostbusters is when they come face to face with Mr. Stay Puft,
the giant marshmallow man,
the villain of the series, who will decide whether or not humanity itself survives, is a huge marshmallow man, who was interestingly made of 50 gallons of shaving cream, you know, on set. Now, they're just throwing that at the actors. So basically, they decide if they could destroy this marshmallow fellow, would they be fine? Mr. Stay Puft was created by using miniatures, interestingly, optical compositing, and a special effects guy in a latex suit.
Oh, so the number one giant kid-friendly thing is actually a miniature.
Yeah, that's it, basically. So the latex suit cost $20,000, okay? And they had several of them, and they're all made and destroyed during the film. So no guy can wander around going, hey, original latex.
But Marshmallow Men were harmed. Marshmallow Men were harmed in the creation of Ghostbusters.
No, marshmallows were harmed.
Oh.
It was all shaving cream.
Well, there's something you don't see every day.
I tried to think of the most harmless thing. Something I loved from my childhood. Something that could never, ever possibly destroy us. Mr. Stay Puft.
Nice thinking, Ray.
We used to roast Stay Puft marshmallows by the fire at Camp Wakanda.
Ray has gone bye-bye, Egon. What have you got left?
Sorry, Beckman. I'm terrified beyond the capacity for rational thought.
Wow, you know, people
I'm
talk
so
about
looking
their,
forward to the remake.
People talk about their past coming back to haunt them, and, you know, you can't get away from your childhood, but your childhood actually comes to you to life, giant-sized life, and tries to kill you in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Terrifying, but
hot
still...
marshmallow is terrifying. Honestly, who hasn't been burnt by a hot marshmallow?
But great choice for your number one pick on the giant kid-friendly. That was a tough top five list, but you did a nice job. Well played.
Thank you.
So that was this week. We've finished up the show, but heading towards next week, Mark, what is going on the big picture?
Next week, it is 007 week.
A 007 crazy.
It's James Bond is back with Spectre. We'll be doing a big coverage of that next week. Very excited to be part of that show next week. There's lots of Bond stuff.
We'll go back to Bond's early days. I think we're going to go to gadgets, probably go to villains. We might even talk a little bit about small screen spies and how they affect kids.
And this will be our first on-air episode on Hope 103.2 FM. So look forward to Bond Fantastic as we bring you the best of secret agents and all sorts of stuff. See you next week.
I will still be Ben McKechnie, even when we're on air.
And I will be Mark Hadley, though a little fresher.
The Big Picture is a Bible Society Australia production and part of Hope 103.2's family of podcasts and vodcasts.